Well, welcome everybody, and thank you for attending this webinar, Preparing Your IRA for 2023 Taxes and Changes. My name is John Paul Ruiz, and I'll be your instructor for today's webinar. A little bit of indemnification or a little bit of a caveat here before we get started. The Untrust Group does not provide investment advice or endorse any products. This webinar is really for informational purposes only. All parties again are encouraged to consult with their attorneys, accountants, and financial advisors before entering into any type of investments or making any type of contributions. Make sure that you do avail of a competent tax or legal advisor. The agenda for today's seminar will include a little bit about the Untrust Group, and then we'll dive into the material. We'll talk about 2023 dates and deadlines IRA holders need to know if they would like to make a contribution or would like to set up an employer-sponsored plan as an example. And then we'll take a look at the new limits. Every year, the IRS issues what we call cost of living adjustments that could change the amounts that we can contribute to these tax-preferred accounts, mainly IRAs, as well as we're going to pull in other tax-preferred accounts such as your health savings accounts. And we're going to talk about a little bit of tips up for the upcoming tax season, and then we'll open up the phone lines for any questions you may have. The first 45 minutes or so of this webinar will focus mainly on the materials that we're going to be presenting on, and then on the last half, we're going to open up the floor for any questions you may have in regards to the material presented. So please write copious notes, and if you have any questions, please put it on the question. Type up your question, and we'd be more than happy to take a look at your question and answer your questions at the end of this webinar. All right. Again, my name is John Paul Ruiz, the Director of Professional Development here at the Untrust Group. And enough of me. I've had over 26 years of retirement plan experience, so on and so forth. But this presentation is more for you. Let's take a look at what we're going to be diving into. A little bit about the Untrust Group. For those of you who don't know the Untrust Group, we've been around for 40 years or so, and we have over $4 billion of assets under administration. And the difference between us and other institutions is the fact that we do have bodies that you can actually talk to in regards to the accounts that you have at the Untrust Group, whereas a lot of organizations have gone through an automated way of responding to their clients. We still have actual individuals that you can talk to, a client service department that you can actually talk to, a business development manager that actually is educated and in most cases certified to actually respond to your questions and needs. We are a self-directed administrator. The focus that we have is not on investments. The focus that we have is on the platform that allows for you, the investor, to choose whatever investment you would like to hold under your retirement plan, of course, as long as it's allowable under law. Our staff is knowledgeable, and most of them have what we call a certified IRA services professional designation through the American Banking Association. We do have nationwide offices, as mentioned earlier. We do have brick and mortar offices that individuals actually are in certain parts of the country. So if you ever wanted to engage with one of our business development managers to talk to your group about self-direction, please reach out to us. We do have in-person events as well as virtual seminars just like this one. We are also a national continuing education program provider for other credentials, such as a certified financial planner, CPAs, enrolled agents from the IRS, as well as other designations as well. And we do hold a biannual, what we call IRA Academy. It's a school that I've developed that's approved by the American Banking Association that prepares individuals for the Certified IRA Services Professional designation. Now, not only do we train our own staff, but we also train other organizations. Now, what is a self-directed IRA? Self-directed IRA, unlike other IRA providers that you've encountered, like Schwab or TD Ameritrade, Wells Fargo Bank, or any other institutions. The reason why they got into the IRA world is the fact that not only do they offer the platform to set up an IRA, they also offer you the investments available at their organization. What if, however, you wanted to invest in a piece of real estate or a private placement or precious metal? Some of these organizations cannot provide that since the platform that they offer cannot hold or service or administer those particular accounts. That's where a self-directed administrator comes in. A self-directed administrator does not offer any investments, but in turn offers the platform that allows an individual to avail of a broad array of investments to be held under their retirement plan. You know, whereas again, some custodians or some IRA providers will not be able to hold those assets, not because they're not capable of or able to do it because of their charter. It's just that they're not able to record keep or administer those accounts to keep those accounts tax deferred. And that's what a self-directed IRA administrator is. Now, diving into the materials, let's take a look at 2023 dates and deadlines are significant for you as an IRA holder or someone who's contemplating and setting up an IRA. On January 31st, if you already have an IRA in existence and you took a distribution, you will receive what we call an IRS Form 1099-R. Because keep in mind, assets in a retirement plan generally have never been taxed before. If someone takes money out of an IRA, in other words, takes a distribution, in our world, in the self-directed world, for example, somebody has a piece of real estate and it's titled under the IRA, if they retitle that account or retitle that asset to their own name, in essence, they've taken a distribution from that, the custodian or the self-directed administrator or any administrator is responsible to tell the IRS that you took money out, because that can cause what we call taxation in most cases, unless, of course, you have a Roth. And if an individual has satisfied what we call a qualified distribution criteria, then those assets could be tax-free. Nonetheless, any amounts leaving an IRA must be reported under what we call an IRS Form 1099-R. That includes the required minimum distributions individuals are due to take the moment they reach the magical age of age 72. The fair market value of that individual's asset will be reported on the IRS Form 1099-R. So if you have an asset at a self-directed administrator, make sure that you provide them the most current fair market value, because if you don't, well, then they'll report the last known fair market value that they will report on that IRS Form 1099-R, which could cause larger taxation based on the information that is received by the custodian. Article 5 of the IRS Form 5305 that was used to establish an individual's IRA says that the depositor or the grantor is responsible to provide that information to the custodian. So if the information is not correct, well, that's because the IRA holder did not provide the correct information. Now, the fair market valuation or the fair market value amount for an individual's IRA is reported to the IRA holder as well on January 31st of the year following the calendar year. Now, keep in mind, if all the assets in the account are assets that the IRA holder have chosen, then, of course, that fair market value amount must come from the IRA holder. Unlike other institutions where they actually offer the investments, they're the ones that will populate the fair market value on an individual's IRA. That fair market value is very important. Why? Especially for individuals who are age 72, because that's the amount that is going to be used in calculating an individual's required minimum distributions. So some custodians may, you know, ask for that fair market value. And the next question is, do I have to get an appraisal on a yearly basis? And the answer is no. If it doesn't involve taxation, an appraisal is not required. However, if it does involve taxation, the IRS does require for any assets that are valued at $5,000 or more for that individual to get an appraisal, because that appraisal or that value is actually used to determine the taxability of a particular distribution. But if it's just going to show the fair market value or the value of an individual's IRA, there are alternative methods that custodians will accept, such as if it's a piece of real estate, a broker's opinion, or a property tax record, a property tax statement may suffice. However, again, if it's a taxable distribution, don't be surprised if the custodian does require an appraisal, because the IRS does require that. Some values may be difficult to acquire, such as partnerships and LLCs, given the fact that partnerships and LLCs have until their tax return due date plus extensions to provide the value of an individual's portion or ownership in a partnership, or in some cases, an S corp as an example, before they actually, or a corporation, C corp as an example, before they determine the value of an individual's or an IRA's ownership in those particular types of entities. In some cases, it may not be reflected on the fair market value. And if there's no taxation, it's not a big deal. However, eventually that fair market value, once it's uploaded in the system, will show up on the fair market value in the next year's fair market value cycle. Required minimum distributions are also required by December 31st of every year. And that fair market value, again, is used. To be specific, it's the prior year's fair market value. Let me give an illustration. If an individual is taking an RMD for tax year 2022, the fair market value for tax year 2021 is used in the formula to calculate the required minimum distribution, which means that by January 31st, which is where the fair market value is required to be reported to the IRA holder, there is a means of calculating the required minimum distribution of an individual throughout that year already, because the prior year end balance is used to calculate that required minimum distribution for the current year. Now, there is a requirement for custodians to provide a notice, and that notice can be found under Notice 2002-27. It's been a while since that notice was issued, that requires custodians to notify an IRA holder that has to take out an RMD due for the year, or provide them an amount that could be used to calculate or to use to distribute that amount from that individual's IRA. So in other words, the financial institution could offer, number one, notifying them that there's an RMD due and offer to calculate if the IRA holder would like it to be calculated, or a custodian could actually just provide an amount. Now, that amount may differ from what the IRA holder should distribute. And the reason why I say that is because generally, custodians will use one table. It's called the Uniform Lifetime Table. And that table reflects the IRA holder's age and an assumed beneficiary 10 years younger. However, what if a person is married to someone a lot younger than 10 years? Then there has to be a specific age that needs to be used for that spouse who is the sole beneficiary of that IRA to further reduce the RMD. However, nonetheless, it's just the IRS's attempt to make sure that somebody is notifying individuals who have reached RMD age that they're supposed to take out a minimum amount for the year. Other resources where an individual could actually find a calculator to calculate their own RMD is through the SEC website under what we call investor.gov. Investor.gov. Investor.gov does have a calculator that if you wanted to find out what your RMD is for the year or required minimum distribution is for the year, just enter in your prior year end balance, enter in the age that you would attain as of your birthday for a particular year, and voila, that calculator will spit out an RMD that's supposed to be distributed from your IRA. Failure to distribute an RMD has a penalty associated with it, and that penalty is 50%. That 50% penalty is also known as what we call the excess accumulation penalty. I kind of went nerdy on you a little bit there. The excess accumulation penalty is the term used for that 50% penalty for an RMD that's failed to be distributed. Now, again, what is the IRS Form 1099-R? The Form 1099 reports any taxable income or any income from an IRA that is being distributed. Now keep in mind, the 1099-R also must reflect the amounts withheld if a taxpayer chose to have an amount withheld from their distribution. That typically shows up on what we call box 4 of the IRS Form 1099-R. This box 4, reflecting the federal income tax withheld, must be, or this 1099-R, must be attached to your IRS Form 1040 in order for the IRS to know how much has been withheld from your distribution. Without attaching the information on the IRS Form 1099-R with your IRS Form 1040, which is your tax return, the IRS will not have any proof that the amount has actually been withheld. I don't know if you know this, but even though an amount is showing up on a 1099-R, the IRS really doesn't know how much a specific individual's amount that would have been withheld from that particular distribution, because the custodians typically send one big check for all distributions that they've taken throughout the year from all their clients. That's why An IRS Form 1099-R must be filed with their IRS Form 1040 to show that individual's taxpayer, specifically to the IRS, the amount that's been withheld from that particular distribution. Now, here are some significant dates. If you are an individual that would like to set up what we call an employer-sponsored plan, such as your SEP or your individual 401k plan, the deadline for an S-corporation and partnership is March 15th to do that. In other words, for tax year 2022, not only are the contributions due by the tax return due date plus extensions of an employer, a partnership and an S-corporation could also establish your employer-sponsored plans, such as your SEP plans, as well as your individual 401k plans by their tax return due date. March 15th is the initial deadline for S-corporations and partnerships. However, if they file for an extension, they have an additional 6 months. We'll take a look at that when we get to September to actually, you know, file their return, which also makes the deadline, you know, whatever it is. It's either their tax return due date or their extension. Now, keep in mind, why did Congress choose the tax return due date plus extensions? Some businesses don't even know how much they would have made until they filed a return. That's why Congress said, you know, by the time you file a return plus extensions, you can decide at that point whether or not you'd like to have an employer-sponsored plan such as a SEP or an individual 401k plan. Now, for existing SEP plans and individual 401k plans, that is also the deadline to make a contribution for such plan that they already had in existence. Now, for making an IRA contribution, if an individual has a required minimum distribution, generally the deadline to distribute that required minimum distribution for their first year's RMD, only for the first year alone. In other words, if a person turned 72 in 2022, although the deadline is generally December 31st, they can actually postpone that first year's RMD up until April 1st of the year following the year that they turn 72. However, keep in mind, they're going to have two RMDs that particular year. Now, since April 1st falls on a weekend, well, guess what? Generally, for acts called tax acts, in other words, filing a return, making a contribution, they typically generally have the following business day. However, this is not a tax act, and it's just a distribution requirement. So therefore, they do not get the following business day to distribute their RMD. So given the fact that April 1st of 2023 falls on a weekend or a holiday, then March 31st is the ultimate deadline for that taxpayer to distribute the required minimum distribution. All right. Now, what about the tax return due date? Given the fact that the tax return due date is when an individual is going to have to file their taxes, and if it falls on a weekend or a holiday, well, an individual gets the following business day. That's why April 18th of 2023 is significant. Generally, again, when April 15th falls on a weekend or a holiday, the taxpayer gets the following following business day to make that contribution. Unless, of course, the town that they live in celebrates a national holiday, such as Patriots Day or Emancipation Day, then they get a further extension on their deadline to make a contribution. But generally, for 2022, and the deadline in 2023 would be April 15th, if it falls on a weekend or a holiday, they have until April 18th. That is the deadline to make a contribution to an IRA. Now, keep in mind, this deadline is also for sole proprietors and C corporations to not only establish, but contribute to a SEP plan or an individual 401k plan. However, if an individual is making an IRA contribution, just a regular individual IRA contribution, they do not get an extension, whereas employer contributions do get their extensions as a further extension of what they can not only establish, but contribute to their plan. April 18th is also a deadline to recharacterize a current year contribution. What does that mean? If an individual made a contribution to a traditional and they changed their mind and said, you know what, I'd be better off with a Roth. Uncle Sam says, as long as you haven't filed your taxes plus extensions, just move it from the traditional to a Roth without any taxation. Another way I call that when I teach financial organizations, it's an oops transaction. Oops, I made a contribution to the traditional. I really meant for that to be going to a Roth. Go to your financial institution, change that current year contribution from one type of IRA to another. You can do that whether it be whole or in part, but be prepared that the amount moving over from one type of IRA to the other type of IRA must include the earnings. Must include the earnings. Now, if you have an education savings account, April 28th is the deadline for custodians to send out what we call an IRS Form 5498 ESA. Not only will it contain the fair market value of that education savings account, any contributions that are made will also be reflected on that IRS Form 5498 ESA. Again, I'm kind of flying through this material. Please jot any questions down that you may have in regards to the material presented. Now, how do you prove to the IRS that an individual actually made a contribution to an IRA or a health savings account? Well, there is a form that is issued by custodians that reflects contributions made to IRAs as well as health savings account. And that is what we call the IRS Form 5498 for IRAs and the 5498SA for health savings accounts. Now, a separate 5498 is going to be generated and provided for each individual that has an IRA at the financial institution. In other words, if an individual has two traditional IRAs at the financial institution, generally you will receive two 5498s. If an individual has a traditional IRA and a Roth IRA, you will also receive two 5498s, one for the traditional and one for the Roth. Now keep in mind again, these 5498s reflect not only the fair market value, but it also reflects the contributions that are made to an individual's IRA. Now let's briefly take a look at what each box contains. Box one says that you made a traditional IRA contribution. Simple enough. Box two means that if you took a distribution and rolled it over to your traditional IRA, such as from another IRA or a 401k plan, that will be reported on box two of this form. If an individual took money out of a traditional IRA and contributed that to a Roth IRA via what we call a conversion, do not get this confused with recharacterizations. Traditional IRAs that have been contributed in the past, if an individual says, I really like that Roth, Uncle Sam says, well, you can take your contributions in the past, make it taxable in the year that you convert this thing, and then put that in the Roth as a contribution called a conversion to avail of the tax-free distribution of earnings in the future. That is what we call a conversion. A conversion does not occur for a current year contribution, but instead, if you're just going to move it from one type of IRA to another type of IRA during the current year, that is what we call a recharacterization or a recharacterized amount, which would show up on box four as the money leaves one IRA and it goes into the appropriate IRA. Box five reports the fair market value of an account. The fair market value of an account. Now, box six does not pertain to IRAs, so we're going to skip that one. Box eight deals with what we call SEP contributions. If an individual is making an employer contribution called a SEP contribution, and that SEP contribution is just reported in the year that it's received by the financial institution. One of the things I forgot to tell you is that if somebody's going to make a contribution prior to April 15 of next year and designate that for the prior year, that amount should also be included in box one, even though it was received in 2023. If the taxpayer indicates that that contribution in writing was for a prior year, then the custodian should report that on box one for the prior year. Whereas a SEP plan, it's just reported in the year that the custodian receives it, and it's up to the taxpayer to report it to the appropriate year that that SEP contribution is associated with. Same likewise goes with simple contributions, which is on box nine. Last but not least, for box 10, if an individual has a Roth IRA and they made a contribution, that will be reported on box 10. Now, pay close attention to box 11 if an individual is over the age of 72 or 72 and older. How does the IRS know that an individual is age 72 and older? And that will be indicated on box 11. In the year that this IRS Form 5498 is created, meaning May 31st of the year following the calendar year, so in other words, for tax year 2022, next year by May 31st, which is when the deadline is to create and send out this IRS Form 5498, in 2023, if an individual is supposed to take out a required minimum distribution, that box will be checked by the custodian or trustee of the IRA. That will indicate to the IRS that this individual is required to take a required minimum distribution. And if the custodian is choosing to provide this amount to the IRA holder using the IRS Form 5498 in lieu of what we call a fair market value statement, well, box 12A and 12B will also be populated, all right? Enough of those boxes. At least you know a little bit of what each box is talking about as it's issued by a custodian. June 1st. For those of you who still have education savings accounts for tax year 2022 and an over contribution was received by that, what we call designated beneficiary, or in which case it's a minor, then that excess contribution to that education savings account must be removed by June 1st. June 1st is the deadline again to remove an excess contribution to an education savings account. Now, as we proceed along to the deadlines associated with the year or the tax return due date year, September 15 is the deadline for S-corporations and partnerships that file for what we call an extension. If you file for an extension, generally, the deadline is March 15. They automatically get 6 months from there. Therefore, the new deadline would be September 15. This is also the deadline, again, for establishing your SEP plans and individual 401k plans. Now, for tax year 2023, if an employer is wanting to set up what we call a simple plan, and the deadline generally is October 1st, however, if October 1st falls on a weekend or a holiday, well, they don't get the following business day. They have up until September 29th to establish that simple plan for tax year 2023. Because October 1st of 2023 is the deadline to establish a simple plan for tax year 2023. For October, which is the month in which that six-month extension from April 15th falls under, October 16th is the deadline, again, for C corporations and sole proprietors who filed for an extension under tax return. It's not only the date in which sole proprietors and C corporations can establish a SEP plan or an individual 401k plan, it is also the time where contributions must be made by those C corps or S corps for established plans already. Last but not least, October 31st is the deadline for simple plan employers to receive the documents that are necessary to fulfill their notice requirement to their employees for the following plan years. In other words, if they're going to choose to maintain a simple plan for tax year 2024, October 31st is the deadline for financial institutions to provide the necessary forms to employers so that they can provide it to their employees, which leads us to what is the deadline for employers to provide those notices that they're going to be maintaining a simple plan for the following year, as well as it allows for the employees to choose whether or not they want to defer a portion of their paycheck into what we call a simple plan. November 2nd is that deadline, which gives 60 days prior to the beginning of 2024 to satisfy the time frame that the IRS requires for employers to provide that particular notice. Now, November 11th is an internal deadline for the NTrust Group for tax year 2023. We will be sending a notice out on November 11th to notify IRA holders that you're going to need to send us a fair market value so we can do our custodial duties and provide that information to the IRS. November 11th is an internal, in other words, it's an NTrust deadline on when we should receive that fair market value amount. Now, December 31st is generally the deadline to distribute a required minimum distribution. However, again, December 31st, 2023 falls on a weekend or a holiday. So if an individual has a required minimum distribution and it's not a tax act, they must come on the prior business day to distribute their RMD. That's the last day that they can have to distribute their RMD to avoid what we call the 50% penalty. It is also the deadline for beneficiaries to set up what we call inherited accounts for individuals who died in 2022. All right, enough of the deadlines. If you have any questions, again, please jot your questions down in regards to the deadlines that we just talked about. Now let's take a look at contribution limits and ranges, all right? Yay, we got a new limit for tax year 2023. The limit for IRAs have gone up from 6,000 to 6,500. So individuals that are wanting to make a contribution for tax year 2023, we got a larger amount of contribution to be made. Whereas in 2022, the maximum is 6,000. We actually got an inflationary indexed increase on contributions to 6,500. So for tax year 2022, not only can they contribute 6,000, they can put an additional 1,000 if the individual is age 50 or older before they enter their taxable year, which makes their maximum at 7,000. For 2023, it's 6,500 plus an additional 1,000 for people who are age 50 and older, which gives them a maximum of 7,500. Now, the income limits to determine deductions for IRAs. What does that mean? A little bit of a background. If a person contributes to a traditional IRA, their contribution is not automatically deductible if they're covered by what we call an employer-sponsored plan. Covered by an employer-sponsored plan means a contribution was made by them or on their behalf to an employer-sponsored plan, like a 401k plan, a 403b plan, a governmental 457b plan, a SEP or a simple. However, on the other hand, if an individual is not covered by an employer-sponsored plan, contributions to traditional IRAs are automatically deductible. But if they are covered by an employer-sponsored plan, their modified adjusted gross income, and by the way, if you don't know what the modified adjusted gross income is, check with your tax advisor. If their modified adjusted gross income falls below certain thresholds, even if they're covered by an employer-sponsored plan, it's still fully deductible. However, the moment their modified adjusted gross income, based on how they file their tax return, the moment it starts increasing above that bottom threshold, then it starts to phase out their eligibility to deduct their traditional IRA contribution. Let's take a look at an example. For a single individual, the phase out range is 68,000 to 78,000. What does that mean? If a person files as a single filer and their modified adjusted gross income is below 68,000, not only can they participate in that employer plan, they can also make a traditional IRA contribution and fully deduct that contribution from their tax return. If their income falls above 78,000, they no longer are eligible to use that traditional IRA contribution as a tax deduction. Now, you may be asking what happens between 68 and 78. A good rule of thumb to determine deductibility is for every 1,000 that goes over 68,000, it reduces that taxpayer's deductibility by 10%. In other words, if a person is under the age of 59 and a half, under the age of 50, and they make a $6,000 contribution and their income is $69,000, their maximum deduction will no longer be $6,000, but instead $5,400. In other words, 90% of the $6,000. As their modified adjusted gross income exceeds further than 68,000, it reduces the amount that they can use as a tax deduction. Now, what can they do with that amount that's not deductible? They can still make that contribution to the traditional IRA. They may just want to keep track of it because, in essence, those assets are not going to be deductible, therefore taxable in the year of contribution. It is prudent for them to keep track of it using what we call an IRS Form 8606. Another recourse that individual has is that since the contribution is not deductible, they may want to consider contributing that amount to their Roth IRA. As you can see, there's a little bit of strategy that has to go into play by understanding the rules and knowing what is deductible and not deductible, what other choices an individual may have. That's where a competent tax advisor would come in to assist that individual taxpayer and walking them through all those different scenarios. For a married couple filing a joint tax return for 2022, it's between $109,000 and $129,000. Below $109,000 for a married couple filing a joint tax return covered by an employer-sponsored plan, it's still fully deductible. Above $109,000, partially deductible. Over $29,000, it's not deductible at all. For every $1,000 that goes over $109,000, it reduces their deductibility by 5%. That's a good way of looking at that. A married couple filing a separate return is already getting a tax deduction according to Congress. So therefore, their phase-out range or their income levels are a lot lower. As a matter of fact, it's drastically lower. It's between $0 and $10,000. Now, if an individual is covered by an employer-sponsored plan, what if their spouse is not covered by an employer-sponsored plan? Well, that spouse is automatically going to be deemed to be covered by an employer-sponsored plan. However, the spouse of that active participant who is not covered by an employer-sponsored plan has a higher phase-out range. That phase-out range for tax year 2022 is $204,000. So in other words, for the one who's actively covered by an employer-sponsored plan, their phase-out range is different than the one who is married to someone and is not actively covered by an employer-sponsored plan. So there's in some cases, in the same tax return, one individual may be able to use their traditional IRA contribution as a deduction while the other one cannot. All right. That's the takeaway or the message here. For tax year 2023, those numbers have increased, as you can see on your slide. I'm not going to go over each one of them for the sake of time, but at least you know that the income levels for 2023 have gone up. For Roth IRA contributions, there is an income limit. Congress says you cannot be rich to contribute to a Roth. Well, what's rich? Well, these income levels define who's rich. Let's take a look at an example for a single individual. For a single individual, if your modified adjusted gross income is below $129,000, you're not rich. Between $129,000 and $144,000, you're partially rich. And in over $144,000, you cannot make a contribution to a Roth any longer because Congress says you're too rich. For a married couple filing a joint tax return under 204, between 204 and 214, you can make a partial Roth contribution. Over 214, they can no longer make a Roth contribution. But keep in mind, they could still make a traditional IRA contribution, and they may not just be able to deduct it if they're covered by a 401k plan, a 403b, a governmental 457b plan, in essence, an employer-sponsored plan. So there's always a way to make a contribution to an IRA. It just may not be deductible in some cases. For a married couple filing a separate return, the phase-out range is between $0 and $10,000. Now, those numbers for 2023 to determine eligibility to contribute to a Roth has increased. As a matter of fact, it has dramatically increased because it's indexed for inflation. Since inflation is high right now, therefore, those contributions are going to be, or those income levels are going to be a lot higher to determine who can contribute to a Roth IRA. Now, what about the limits for employer-sponsored plans? The contributions for employer-sponsored plans starting off with simple IRA plans have gone up. The deferrals for 2023 for simples have gone up to $15,500, up from $14,000 from tax year 2022. So in other words, if an employer sets up a simple plan for tax year 2023, they can contribute up to $15,500. And in addition to that, if they're age 50 and older, they can make an additional contribution of $3,500. Again, it's an increase from $3,000 from tax year 2022. In other words, they can bank away or shelter more cash in 2023 using their simple IRA employer-sponsored plan from taxation. And the best part is, by contributing it to your own simple IRA, you get to keep that money that you use as a tax deduction for your tax return. For SEP plans, the maximum contribution is generally the lesser of, the smaller of, 25% of an individual's compensation, not to exceed certain dollar figures. The dollar figure for tax year 2022 is $61,000, and the dollar figure for tax year 2023, here we go, it's dramatically increased to $66,000. So if an individual, as long as their compensation will support it, can put up to $66,000, in a SEP IRA under their own account. In other words, you can not only shelter or use that $66,000 as a deduction from your tax return, you get to keep it too, because that contribution is actually made into what we call a SEP IRA. Now, how does the compensation cap apply to these contributions? Keep in mind, if an individual is going to make a contribution and the limit is the lesser of 25% of compensation, if somebody makes $500,000, I'm kind of using an exaggerated amount there, but some people do make that amount of money, you cannot put $125,000 of contributions in your plan. There is a cap, there is a dollar limit, and that is $61,000 again for tax year 2022 and $66,000 for 2023. That's where these compensation caps apply. For an individual 401k plan, it keeps getting better. The maximum contributions are much larger than what we call your simple plan and your SEP plan. In an individual 401k plan, not only can the employer contribute a profit-sharing contributions, because a 401k plan is a profit-sharing plan, they can also defer a portion of their paycheck as a contribution. And for individual 401k plans, if they wanted to contribute employer contributions as a profit-sharing contribution, they have that same limit of $61,000 and $66,000. However, if they're not quite to that $61,000 or $66,000, they can also contribute what we call a deferral. Because keep in mind, the $61,000 and the $66,000 are profit-sharing contributions and deferral contributions combined. So in other words, if an employer is making a profit-sharing contribution and they're also going to make a deferral contribution, the individual must add those two numbers together, making sure that the $61,000 and the $66,000 is not violated. All right? Now, what if an individual is age 50 and older and they already deferred $20,500 for tax year 2022 or $22,500 for tax year 2023, depending upon the year that you're making a contribution? If they fulfilled the maximum deferral amount, they can make an additional contribution called a catch-up contribution. That catch-up contribution is not limited to by the $61,000 and $66,000. So, above and beyond the $66,000, an individual who is age 50 and older, who has maxed out their deferral amount of $22,500 for 2023, can still make an additional $7,500 for tax year 2023. That is a boatload of cash, folks, that an individual could actually not only shelter from their business income from taxation, as well as keep that amount in their own account. And in this case, if I calculated correctly, I don't have a calculator in front of me, $73,500 is the maximum in 2023 for people who are age 50 and older, assuming, of course, that they maxed out on certain limits. Health savings accounts contributions have also gone up a little bit. Single covered plans, it's gone up to $3,850, up from $3,650 for tax year 2022. For family covered individuals, then $7,750 for tax year 2023 and $7,300 for tax year 2022. If an individual is age 50 and older, they can make an additional $1,000 contribution to their HSA. For education savings accounts, it doesn't change because according to the tax code, that amount is not going to be adjusted for cost of living adjustment purposes, so it stays at $2,000. Here are some tips for the upcoming tax season. If you do receive an IRS Form 1099-R, those assets or those amounts typically reported in that are generally taxable to determine the taxability of that particular distribution. Check with your competent tax advisor to determine how taxation is going to affect an individual's tax return. In other words, not only are your taxable incomes from employment, miscellaneous income, not only are those combined together to determine your taxable income for the year, any IRA distributions that have never been taxed before are also included in that amount, which basically could increase the tax liability of a taxpayer. An IRS Form 1099-R, again, will be received or be sent out by January 31st of tax year 2023 for any distributions that occurred in tax year 2022. And that should be included in the tax year 2022's tax return. If there are any amounts withheld from that distribution, those would show up on box four and must be translated to the IRS form 1040, which is the individual taxpayer's tax filing return, to show the IRS, hey, a portion of this amount has been paid to you already. Include that in my withholding or amounts that I've prepaid already for tax purposes. For Roth IRA reporting and taxation, there are two different distributions that we need to take a look at. One of which is what we call a qualified distribution, and the other one is non-qualified. Qualified is the best. Why is that? Because everything in that Roth IRA is tax what? Tax-free. In other words, everything in that Roth IRA will be tax-free. We'll take a look at what constitutes a qualified distribution on the Roth. In some cases where an individual has not satisfied the qualified distribution criteria, it's still not the end of the world. Roth IRAs follow what we call the ordering rules. There is an order of dollars that come out of a Roth IRA. And by the way, when we talk about a Roth IRA, we take a look at all Roth IRAs an individual owns to determine taxation. Not we, but the taxpayer does. So in other words, if an individual has contributed $5,000 in consecutive 3 years, an individual has $15,000 from his Roth IRA, his or her Roth IRA, that can be distributed at any time, no tax, no penalty. It follows a certain order. Contributions come out first. Let's take a look at that later on once we get to what we call the non-qualified distribution criteria designation. Let's take a look first at qualified distributions. What qualifies a Roth to be tax-free? Number one, they must have had a Roth for 5 years. That's it, John Paul? Yep. You must have had a Roth for 5 years. As a matter of fact, the five-year clock for an individual's Roth starts as of January 1st of the year for which a contribution is made. So in other words, if a person is making a Roth contribution today, and this is their first contribution, the clock actually started ticking January 1st of this year. I tell people when I teach all over the country, if you don't have a Roth, what's the moral of the story? Go get one. Some people would say, well, how much should I contribute to start that clock? I would tell them, whatever the financial institution requires as a minimum contribution. In some cases, some credit unions or banks only require $10 to make a contribution to a Roth. So therefore, that $10 started that individual's clock. Once the five-year period has been satisfied, the individual will only be waiting for one of the qualifying events to distribute earnings. Now, keep in mind, contributions to a Roth have been taxed already, so we're not talking about that. We're talking about the earnings or the growth. If a person dies and they've had a Roth for 5 years, all the assets in that individual's Roth is tax-free to the beneficiaries. If an individual becomes disabled, in other words, you know, they can no longer work, earnings on all Roth IRAs of that individual is also tax-free. Once they turn 59 and a half and they've had a Roth for 5 years, all of the Roths of that individual is tax-free. Here's the beautiful part. If an individual is going to take out up to $10,000 of the earnings to purchase their first-time home, and they've had a Roth for 5 years, up to $10,000 of the earnings will also be distributed tax what? Free to purchase that home. Now, what if an individual has not satisfied this criteria? Well, again, the distributions from the Roth works in what we call the ordering rules. Ordering rules means that contributions are coming out first because those have already been taxed. Conversion dollars, if an individual converted from a traditional to a Roth, those come out second. And only if they touch the earnings will the earnings be distributed and taxable just like traditional IRA assets. So what's the moral of the story? Don't take any money out before it's time on a Roth. Additional tax reporting for individuals who may have what we call unrelated business taxable income from their IRAs or qualified retirement plans such as your individual 401k plan must file what we call the IRS Form 990T. This is due by April 15th of the year following the calendar year. In other words, for tax year 2022, if there's UBTI, unrelated business taxable income, that IRS Form 990T must be filed by April 15th. Additional tax reporting for the 990T may also be associated with retirement plans, in this case, IRAs, that borrowed money. In other words, they got a non-recourse loan to purchase a particular investment. That income is what we call unrelated debt finance income, and that's also fileable using the IRS Form 990T. And that is due to the IRS by April 15th of the year following the calendar year. Now, most custodians, if not all, do not prepare that form, but assist in, you know, signing the form, but not necessarily filing that form to the IRS, which means that you may want to seek out the assistance of a competent tax advisor if you need assistance in completing that IRS Form 990T. If you're an IRA holder that has what we call unrelated debt finance income from a particular investment. Investments not subject to UBTI, and for some of you, you're going to go, woo, thank God. Dividends, stock dividends, rental property income. So if all your IRA owns are rental properties, rents are typically not subject to UBTI unless that property was purchased using a loan. In other words, it was leveraged. Royalties, rights, you know, mineral rights, if, so on and so forth. Disposition of property. If an IRA holder bought a piece of property for $100,000 and they sold it for $200,000, well, guess what? There's no capital gains as long as the proceeds from the sale of a property goes back into to an IRA. That's one of the beautiful parts about building wealth under a retirement plan. We've talked about unrelated debt finance income tax. For those of you who don't know what that is that, I don't know if you know this, but your retirement plan can actually borrow money to purchase an investment. In this particular example, somebody wanted to buy a piece of property that's worth $200,000 and they only had $100,000. So in other words, they had 50% of the money to buy the property, 50% that they borrowed. Uncle Sam says, if you have income from that property, well, we're going to have to tax 50% of the income because you didn't use your own money to buy that piece of property. That income that is going to be taxed is what we call unrelated debt finance income tax. That amount is the amount that is fileable using the IRS Form 990T. And that income in IRAs is going to be subject to what we call trust tax rates. Now, if this was an individual 401k plan, on the other hand, UDFI, or unrelated debt finance income, does not apply to 401k plans since it's what we call an employee benefit plan. That's one of the advantages of what we call a solo 401k plan. So if you are an individual who owns an IRA, you go, hey, I didn't know you could do that. Establish an individual 401k plan. You can even roll your assets into an individual 401k plan and do your investing, especially if you're going to do a non-recourse loan under the 401k plan, because you can exponentially build your wealth a lot faster than under an IRA. This is what the IRS Form 990T looks like. And this is the section of the 990T where unrelated debt finance income shows up on the IRS Form 990T. Let's summarize. Mark your calendars, organize your calendars with these important dates. Know the limits if you're going to make a contribution and the phase-out limits to determine deductibility or determining whether or not you're eligible to contribute to a Roth. Take your time with taxes. Exploit as many things as you can to reduce the amount of taxes that you're going to have to pay. That's not illegal. As a matter of fact, that's strategic. So engage with your competent tax or legal advisor, if you have not done so already, in regards to what opportunities you may have to reduce taxation by participating in these plans, or maybe in some cases, establishing these plans. And last but not least, with the help of the interest group, stay updated on laws, because laws do change. We just went through a recent election, and we have new faces that are going to be participating in our government. And new ideas are going to come into play. New pieces of legislation are going to be passed that could affect the look and feel of our retirement plans, in some cases, for the better. So stay tuned. Continue to attend our webinars at the Entrust Group, and we'd be more than happy to tell you what new opportunities lie ahead. What's next again? We have an upcoming webinar, Resort to Real Estate Investing with a Self-Directed IRA. And let us know how we did in this particular webinar. So leave us a response in a survey. And if you want to learn more about self-direction, visit our website at www.theentrustgroup.com. Visit our website again, www.theentrustgroup.com. Now, let's open up the phones for any questions you may have. I kind of went over a little bit, but that's nonetheless, I don't want to shortchange you from what you need to know. Andrew, let's open up the lines for any questions individuals may have in regards to the materials presented.
Sounds great. We'll head towards the chat box. So if you enter anything over there, we will answer these in order. Number one, so RMD is only required once you turn 72, correct?
The question is, RMDs are only required when you turn 72, correct? The answer is yes. For a taxpayer or an IRA holder that is alive, in traditional IRAs and 401k plans, once a person reaches the age of 72, you're going to have to take out a minimum amount or that required minimum distribution. However, as you notice, I didn't mention the Roth. Roth IRAs, while the Roth IRA holder is alive, is not subject to required minimum distributions. So one of the strategies some individuals have been doing is they're converting their traditional IRA assets to Roth IRA assets prior to attaining age 72, or maybe even after they reach age 72, because the moment you move those dollars into a Roth IRA, even if you turn 72, there's no RMDs on a Roth. However, in a traditional IRA and a 401k plan, you are going to be required to take out a minimum once you reach age 72. I hope that answers your question.
And Christine wanted to add also for inherited IRAs, correct?
For inherited IRAs, that's a little bit of a different story. The moment a person dies, the IRS does not want an inheritor to have a perpetual IRA. So therefore, inheritors are going to be forced to take out a small amount. In other words, once a person passes away, inherited accounts are going to be subject to required minimum distributions. And those are what we call your life expectancy options. In other words, life expectancy distribution payments. Or with the passage of the Secure Act of 2019, if a beneficiary is a non-spouse beneficiary greater than 10 years younger, they are not required to take out a distribution generally. However, they are going to have to deplete that account by the 10th year. In other words, the year that contains the 10th anniversary of the IRA holder's death, they're going to have to distribute everything. Now, if the IRA holder died after the age of 72, well, since those required minimum distributions cannot be stopped, even though an individual names a non-spouse beneficiary greater than 10 years younger, and their ultimate deadline to distribute everything is the 10th year, that non-spouse beneficiary is going to be required to take out a minimum amount every year, but in this case, using their own single life expectancy. The single life expectancy of a younger person is a lot larger than an older person. So therefore, even though they have to take out a minimum amount, that minimum amount will be based out of that younger person's life expectancy. So to answer the question in regards to inherited account, it's a little bit different than an individual who's alive and who is the IRA holder.
Thank you, JP. Next question. So hypothetically, if you're purchasing real estate within an SDIRA using an LLC and funding the LLC through a custodian account, the question is, do you need to submit any tax forms for that besides an FMV?
Okay, so the question is, if you funded an LLC using your self-directed IRA, I'm assuming that that's what your question is, are there any other tax forms that need to be provided to, number one, I'm going to extend your question a little bit. What needs to be provided to the custodian at first? All right. First, the custodian needs to be provided the FMV of that LLC in which the IRA invested in. So if there's 10 houses owned by that LLC, what is the fair market value of those 10 houses so that the custodian can actually do their job? In other words, file the FMV or send the FMV by January 31st to the IRA holder, as well as the IRS Form 5498 by May 31st. That's one. If the LLC does have taxable income, in other words, called UBTI, In other words, if that LLC, let's say, decides to engage in activities that generate what we call a trade or business income, and that's where the tax advisor comes in to determine what income it is. If that LLC generates trade or business income, that income is taxable to that IRA who owns that LLC, because the assets that are earned by that LLC are passed on to whoever established that LLC. In this case, it's the IRA that funded that LLC, therefore they're 100% owner in most cases. That pass-through income of income that is considered trade or business income is required to file a tax return if the gross receipts of that LLC is $1,000 or more. All right. Now keep in mind, there are expenses that are involved in that particular LLC that could further reduce the amount of that income and reduce the amount of taxation. But the IRS does say that if an IRA, in this case a retirement plan, invests in that LLC and there's trade or business income with gross receipts of $1,000 or more, they would need to file the IRS Form 990T. Now I'm going to take it a step further. Now whose EIN number will be used to file that LLC's or that IRA's IRS Form 990T. According to the 990T instructions, the IRS says, do not use the trustee or custodian's EIN number, but instead, the IRA needs to get its own. It also says in there, do not use your own Social Security number, because this is your IRA. So therefore, the IRA should get its own EIN number to file that IRS Form 990T. Excuse me. Now keep in mind, this is an LLC that is not necessarily an IRA. It's just an LLC that the IRA invests in. And LLCs are filed for at a state level. There are other requirements some states may require for that LLC to file within the state. And that goes beyond what we know at the Entrust Group, because we only follow the federal level. So depending upon where the LLC was filed, check with that Department of Revenue for that state. In most cases, if the LLC is owned by an IRA, the state says, okay, this is an exempt LLC from any taxation, all right? So generally, those are the two things that need to be filed or required by the custodian as well as governmental entities. So if the LLC also has to require a federal return, that's where the tax advisor comes in. Then there may be also a federal return that needs to be filed with the federal government. So I hope that answers your question. It's kind of a long, broad answer to a simple question.
Thank you. Next question. This one's about HSAs JP. So yep. Question from them. They said their husband and them have high deductible plans. Husband includes mm-hmm. the son plan, so he contributes $7,600. They contribute $3,600. They file joint tax returns. And so the question is, can we both contribute to HSA, one as family and the other as an individual? Thank you.
The question is, if a person is participating in a single plan and the other one is a family plan, what is the limit? The limit is the family plan. In other words, you cannot dip in and double dip. Let's put it this way. I couldn't remember that. You can't double dip. So if an individual is covered by a family plan and the other one is covered by a single plan, they must be covered by a family plan if all family members are covered by the HSA. All right. As a matter of fact, it only requires for an individual who is covered by a family plan to cover one eligible family member. Now, depending upon who is covered by each plan, they could basically look at each other as completely separate plans, but if they're covered by the actual insurance of the high deductible health plans, they are generally limited to the flat, it's the larger one of the two. The general family plan is the general limit. I say general because there's variations to that, all right? So if you're covered by a family plan, that's the general limit, it's the family plan.
Thank you. Next question. So they say, since the title is about preparing your IRA for 2023, Is there anything specifically you would say in general all IRA holders need to do to actually prepare the IRA itself, or is it more being aware of updates and preparing themselves as the holders? Just to please clarify that.
Well, clarifying what additional reporting an IRA may have to do, generally a lot of IRAs do not have to do anything because a lot of the reporting is going to be done by your IRA custodian. In other words, custodian does a lot of that work. However, with the help of the IRA holders, such as your fair market value statements, so on and so forth. However, if there are actions that you've done within that IRA that will generate some tax reporting, be prepared that those have to be filed in some cases with your tax returns, such as the IRS Form 1099-R. Whatever's reported on the IRS Form 1099-R will be taxable in your tax return. So in other words, really depending upon the activity in your IRA will determine whether or not you have something to do or not have anything to do. However, also another issue that you might want to take a look at is that if you are going to make a contribution, be aware of the contribution limits, because not only is it limited, you know, there are also increases in contributions that you could avail of that could benefit you from a tax perspective. So in other words, depending really upon the actions that an individual does within their IRA, there may be some things that you need to do, you know, or in some cases, you may not have anything to do. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you, JP. Next question. Let's say you have a rental property and a non-recourse loan against it. Question, if a tenant pays a full year of rent at 1 month, do they only calculate the monthly rent as UBIT? Thank you.
Let's say an individual has a piece of property at $100,000 with a $50,000 loan on it. How is UBTI calculated based on that particular ratio? One of the things that we didn't talk about is the fact that depending upon the non-recourse loan payment structure, a portion of that loan is going to be paid off on a monthly basis. The IRS says take an average of all the balance on that account for the full entire year and use that ratio to determine what is taxable and what isn't taxable. So in other words, if the renter pays rent on a monthly basis, total that all up, and then use the average ratio of the amount that is owned by the IRA in comparison to the amount of the loan, and then use that as a determination of whether or not, you know, or whatever the portion is that's going to be taxable on rental income. So in other words, let's put it this way. $100,000 piece of property, 50% was used to purchase that property. It just so happens at the end of the year, after payments towards that non-recourse loan has been made, the IRA now owns 60%, or in other words, it owns 60% of that $100,000 piece of property. If $10,000 comes in, instead of 50-50, now you will use 60-40 to determine the portion that's taxable. In other words, only 40% of the income is now going to be taxable, given the fact that a portion of the principal has been paid throughout the year, paying off that non-recourse loan. Hope that makes sense.
Thank you, JP. Next question. Now, I'm sure there's a lot of nuance to this, JP, but if you want to start with a kind of an overarching answer, and I can supply Vivian with some back-end supplemental info on this, but in general, they ask, how do you convert traditional IRA to Roth IRA? So just how do you complete that traditional conversion process?
Oh, it's very easy to convert a traditional IRA to the Roth IRA as long as you're willing to pay the tax liability. The tax liability for a conversion will be determined upon the value that you are distributing from an IRA. And the reason why I caveat that and word it that way is that you can either convert in cash or you can convert in kind. In kind means that there's going to be an appraisal that has to be done generally on that property to determine its value. So in other words, if you have a piece of real estate in the self-directed world, the value that you purchased that real estate for is no longer the current fair market value of that piece of real estate. Getting a current fair market value could either go in your favor or go against you. Why is that? What if you bought a piece of property and now it's worth a lot more than what you used to purchase that property? Well, then, of course, the amount that you're going to be subject to tax will be at that larger value. However, in some cases, what if that the property value of that property has gone down? That's the best time to convert. Why is that? Because the current fair market value of that property will be what is going to be reported on that IRS Form 1099-R for the conversion. The conversion, again, is a taxable distribution from the traditional IRA that gives it an opportunity to be contributed to the Roth as a conversion. Now, keep in mind, if you have a piece of property that has devalued and you can either leave that in a traditional IRA and wait for that property to go back up in value, or you can convert that in the year that that value of that investment is lower, put it in your Roth. As it comes up, the earnings on that Roth will now enjoy in the future tax-free distribution of earnings. So it's as simple as taking a distribution and making a contribution to the Roth IRA. Now keep in mind, those assets that are going to be taxed during the year, you may want to keep track of it. Why is that? Because those assets have been taxed already. Because what if you haven't had a Roth for 5 years? Well, guess what? Then you're still waiting for the 5-year clock to transpire before you can actually distribute the earnings tax-free. So you may want to keep track of the basis or the amount that's been converted. The form that is used to report that conversion, if you have Google IRS Form 8606 and look at Part 2 of that form. Part 2 of that form reports any conversions that are done during that year to keep track of the basis or the dollars that are going to be taxed in that year, so that when that distribution of that basis is distributed prior to reaching what we call a qualified distribution criteria, it will allow for those basis to be distributed tax what? Free, because you've already been taxed on it, as long as you keep track of it. That's what we call an IRS Form 8606. So Vivian, the nuance or the mechanics of converting from a traditional to a Roth is taking a distribution from the traditional and contributing that to a Roth. Now, another question people may have asked is, what if I am under the age of 59 and a half? Generally, distributions from an IRA are not only subject to tax, it could also be subject to the early distribution penalty. Well, I have good news for you. When you convert, it doesn't matter how old you are, Congress waives the 10% penalty. So in other words, if you're going to convert, you don't have to reckon with a 10% penalty as long as the amount that you've distributed is converted to a Roth. In other words, do not have an amount withheld from the distribution if you're going to convert. Some people make the mistake of having an amount withheld from the distribution and they're under age 59 and a half and they converted. Why am I bringing that up? Imagine if you have 100 grand and you wanted to convert that to a Roth and you had 10% withheld. In other words, you only have $90,000 left and that's the only amount that went to a Roth. Well, did you really convert the full amount? The answer is no. You only converted $90,000 because $10,000 you had withheld and that was sent to Uncle Sam. If you're under the age of 59 and a half, that $10,000 that was withheld was not converted, so therefore not only will it be subject to a tax, it'll also be subject to an additional penalty. So only amounts that are converted are not subject to the 10% penalty. So what's the moral of the story? If you're under the age of 59 and a half, convert the full amount. Determine what you can convert. In other words, determine what you can afford to pay taxes on and then proceed accordingly. I hope I gave you all the little nuances and details that you need to know about a conversion. And also check with your tax advisor, because they're the ones that can give you a projection of how much tax you may owe in regards to that conversion. That'll also tell you whether or not to proceed or not. So,
thank you. And then as far as the different steps on how to, is that something you would go over, or is that something you would refer to different resources?
How to is something that's not a tax advice, but how to is just the mechanics of how to do it. However, the taxation on that distribution is something that I would refer you to somebody else.
Got it.
We don't determine the taxation on it.
Great. Cool. Well, quick follow-up on that kind of property with a tenant that paid off the whole year. So with regard to that UBIT, it's hard for us to say better or not, just for the person asking. But the question is it better to pay off the principal to help avoid the UBIT tax?
The more you can, the quicker you can pay off the principal on a particular asset that's owned by an IRA that was purchased using a non-recourse loan, the better off you are. Why is that? Because then it'll help avoid or eliminate eventually the unrelated business taxable income. I had a client that basically bought a $267,000 piece of property, and rental income was coming in so rapidly and with a non-recourse loan. It says, can I just use the amount to pay off that loan sooner? And I said, absolutely. The quicker you can pay off that loan, the quicker your IRA will own that property and minimize or eventually eliminate that UBTI tax.
Great. Thank you, JP. This one's pretty straightforward. When purchasing real estate with an IRA, does it always have to be with an LLC?
For purchasing piece of real estate with an IRA, the LLC does not have to be there. I'm gonna let the cat out of the bag. Some LLC providers that actually make money out of setting up the LLC says it's to your best benefit to set up an LLC. But I'm going to be honest with you, it's not required. Depending upon what you want to accomplish, check with your legal advisor to determine whether or not it's advantageous for you to set up an LLC. In some cases, I'm not going to say it automatically does. In some cases, some legal advisors have said that it could help prevent you in the event of a lawsuit, as an example, because the LLC is the one that owns the pieces of real estate. We can't make an opinion on that because we're not legal counsels. Some individuals also say, if I do an LLC and my fees are generally charged on a per asset basis, if I didn't have the LLC, I'm going to get charged on a per house for each house that I own under my IRA. And that's true, which means it could reflect a higher level of fees that I would have to pay for my assets under my IRA. But if I get an LLC, since the IRA only has one investment called an LLC, all right, and even if I own 20 houses, kind of exaggerated, but you know, you get the point. 20 houses under that LLC, I'll only get charged for one investment. Well, that definitely will benefit you from that perspective. But is it necessary to have an LLC? Not necessarily. As a matter of fact, one of the main reasons some people set up an LLC is the fact that LLC can set up a checking account. Then if they wanted to move on a piece of property, it's a lot quicker because they already have a checking account. Now, keep in mind, last year, Richard Neal, the Congressman Richard Neal, the head of the HELP Committee, Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions, that's where they get that acronym HELP from, introduced a piece of legislation that if it had passed, would have gotten rid of the LLC structure. In other words, the IRS kind of actually frowns upon the LLC structure because of what we call the prohibited transaction rules. The prohibited transaction rule says that an IRA cannot own an entity that is owned 50% or more by a disqualified party. So if you set up an LLC and you're the general manager as the IRA holder of an LLC, what does that represent? Well, you're managing the assets, incomes, and losses of a particular investment, you personally, without involving your custodian on an LLC. So there are some legal aspects of it that could be derogatory to the IRS, but nonetheless, if you know, proceed cautiously, talk to a legal counsel if you're going to set up an LLC when buying pieces of real estate, because it's not just the benefit of the LLC that we need to take a look at. You also need to take a look at whether or not there's some prohibited transactions that have been violated by setting up an LLC, managing the LLC that is owned by your IRA. So some people say, this is an IRS-approved investment. I will give you a publication, Publication 3125. If you have Google, Google it. Publication 3125 explicitly says that the IRS does not approve investments. So if you ever see an institution that says, well, this is an IRS-approved investment, and our investment that we're offering is this, I would proceed with caution. One of the reasons why we've been around for over 40 years is we always look at things conservatively, you know, and we don't like to put our clients in a compromising position. That's why I'm giving you all this material so that you can actually do your proper due diligence before you enter into any transaction. Of course, highly recommended, seek the assistance of a competent tax or legal advisor. But to answer your question again, do you need an LLC? No, you don't.
Thank you. Next question. If I already own an LLC but paid for it out of pocket, can my SD IRA or SOTHO 401k buy it from me?
The answer is no, because of the prohibited transaction rules. If you own it, control it, you own 50% or more of the combined voting powers of a particular entity, that becomes a disqualified party under Section 4975 of the Internal Revenue Code. And by the way, the IRS actually has a section of their website devoted on prohibited transactions, and that's where you would find that 4975. You know, if you have a sale, exchange, leasing, performing services between an IRA and a disqualified entity, in this case, since you own it, all right, you can't have a sale or exchange, and that's what you're asking, I would say you cannot do it. 4975 of the Internal Revenue Code.
Thank you, JP. Next question. If I over-contribute to an HSA, can I request a refund?
If you over-contributed to an HSA, you can actually either do one of two things. You can either pay a penalty and carry that contribution forward to the following year, or you can actually remove that amount as what we call an excess distribution. An excess distribution removes the contribution plus the earnings associated with that contribution, and that only the excess earnings are going to be taxable upon that distribution. So you can do either one of two things. You can pay the penalty and carry forward that contribution in excess to the following year. In other words, you can only make less than whatever that amount is that you've already made for the following year, right? Or you can actually distribute that amount along with the earnings.
Great, thank you very
much. In other
words,
being refunded back to you, you know, the contribution plus the earnings, yeah.
Great. So, next question. If you have a loss this year in a traditional IRA, and if you opened a Roth, can you use part of the loss towards the tax generated from converting the Roth?
The loss in an IRA is non-existent because it's already a tax-deferred account. Unlike assets that are outside of an IRA, in an IRA, gains and losses are suppressed. So if you have a loss, unless you actually lost so much that the value of your IRA goes below the value of your non-deductible contributions, there's no way for you to take that loss at all. Yeah. So losses inside an IRA, which is tax deferred, by the way, right, cannot be used, unlike losses outside of a retirement plan. In other words, if you lost on a business loss or all that, that losses inside of an IRA investment is not, does not help you in the tax return.
Thank you. Next question. If I have multiple Roth accounts from multiple employers, can I roll all of them into the oldest Roth to avoid paying anything regarding 5-year penalty on withdrawal?
All Roth IRAs are considered as one big Roth IRA, so they're not treated differently. If you have Roth 401k plans in multiple employers, keep in mind, all right, if you've already had a Roth for 5 years and over, and let's say you've only had a Roth 401k plan for 3 years, if that Roth 401k plan is rolled into that Roth IRA, it takes on the characteristics of that Roth IRA. So in other words, it's advantageous to have an older Roth than your 401k plan. So in your question, if you've had Roth 401k plans in multiple employers, and assuming that you can actually take a distribution of those assets, in other words, you've reached what we call a distributable event. I call it a trigger. You've reached a trigger that you can actually take money out of that Roth 401k plan, and you've only had 4 years as an example on those plans, but you've had a Roth that's been around for 10 years. Guess what? It's advantageous to roll those assets to the Roth IRA. Why? because it wipes out everything that you've earned in that 401k plan and actually take on the benefit of what you've already accrued or accumulated in your Roth IRA. I hope that makes sense. So if your Roth IRA is older than your 401k plan and you can take that money out, it is advantageous to roll it into that Roth IRA.
Thank you, JP. Next question. We sold a long-term real estate with 200K gain. We want to do a large Roth conversion, which will raise our tax rate. Question, will the long-term capital gain be taxed at a maximum rate since the conversion will send us into 32% tax rate? Thank you.
So when you say you sold a piece of property at long-term gains rate, I have a return question and you could clarify this. Was this piece of property purchased outside of an IRA? That's a question for the person asking the question.
Mm-hmm. I'll see if they follow up. In the meantime, while we get that, I'll just move on to a confirming question. I think you just covered this, but if you have a conversion, sorry, JP, they just responded. Yes, not in an IRA. Thank you.
Yeah. The long-term gains in outside of an IRA is going to be taxable to you. And that's going to be either, it's going to be taxable in your Schedule D of your return. All right. If you convert inside an IRA, that does not affect your long-term or short-term gains rate. That amount will just be included in your taxable income, which could basically determine your taxation for your long-term gains rate. In other words, that's going to be included in your income for the, and I don't know what that income is, because it's either going to get taxed at 15% or 20-some-odd%, depending upon what your income is, right? So your conversion will be tacked on to your taxable income for the year, which could exponentially increase your income for the year, which could make your long-term gains rate be taxed at a higher rate. So run the math with your tax advisor to determine how much you may be willing to convert because conversions are generally determined by how much you can afford, right? So check with your tax advisor from that perspective.
Thank you, JP. I think you clarified this, but just to confirm, with conversion income, it can't be offset with capital losses, right? I believe that's what one of the questions asked earlier, but just to clarify.
Okay. Conversion, taxable income from conversions can be offset by other losses you may have in your tax return, because that all of those come into play to determine what your overall taxable income is for the year. So if your taxable income goes up because of the conversion, but you also have a loss outside on a different investment, then that will reduce the amount of your taxable income for the year. That could benefit you. Check with your tax advisor in regards to that.
Great. Thank you for clarifying that. Next question. Can you use an HSA to purchase investment property?
Can you use an HSA to purchase investment property? The answer is yes. HSAs are treated the same way as traditional IRAs, Roth IRAs, SEP IRAs, and simple IRAs. It could even partner with your Roth, your traditional, your SEP, or your simple IRA if you don't have enough money in the HSA. Yes.
Thank you so much. Last question here. I have a TSP plan, and how can I transfer that to an SD IRA?
Well, you have a TSP plan, meaning a thrift savings plan. If that thrift savings plan is under section 401A of the code, which means the first step that you have to do is check with your plan administrator of that thrift savings plan. If that thrift savings plan is under section 401A of the code, that is what we call a qualified retirement plan. Qualified retirement plans that are subject to 401A of the code are eligible to be directly rolled over to a traditional IRA. So therefore, you just need to instruct your employer, if it can be rolled over to an IRA, to make your balance payable to your self-directed IRA. So I'm going to give you an example. The Entrust Group for the benefit of John Doe's traditional IRA. Don't ever make that check payable to you. Make it payable to the IRA, so therefore you avoid taxation. There will be an IRS Form 1099-R that will be issued with a code G on it. I'm giving you a lot more information you probably care to hear about, but it's good to know that so that when you get the 1099-R, we need to make sure that the employer actually reported it properly. But with a code G, that'll tell the IRS that this was directly rolled over. Now, depending upon the assets that you have in your thrift savings plan, I'm assuming it's all pre-tax because most of them are, they'll be rolled into your traditional IRA. Your traditional IRA then in turn will receive will generate an IRS form 5498. It's one of those forms that we talked about. It'll show up on box two. So whatever came out of the thrift savings plan must equal the amount on box two of the 5498 so that the IRS knows, oh, you just moved your money from an employer plan to an IRA. And if the IRA is at the interest group, now you can self-direct. It's just like any other IRA, except in the self-directed world, self-directed administrators don't offer any investments. But you can choose to invest in whatever investment you want as long as it's allowable under law. I hope I illustrated the mechanics of that for you.
Thank you, JP. Last bit here is not a question, just a comment back that I would love your tidbit on. So regarding offsetting losses, this person writes, they believe you're incorrect on conversion tax being offset by losses elsewhere on the tax return because only $3,000 of losses can be applied against your other income and the rest of the losses carried forward for future years. Comment?
Okay. Well, it still affects it though, but so check with your tax advisor then to determine whether or not your losses, all of your losses, could be used to offset your taxable taxable income for the year.
Great. And with that, we have nothing else. So if you want to bring us home and wrap us up, that'd be great. Thank you, JP.
All right. Well, thank you for attending today's seminar. I hope that the dates and the increase in contributions assist you or helps you in regards to navigating or making decisions for the following tax year. We answered a lot more information than what was covered in the presentation. But remember again, the Entrust Group does not provide tax or legal advice. So therefore, it is important to check with your tax or legal advisor before proceeding with any transaction. With that in mind, again, my name is John Paul Ruiz, Director of Professional Development here at the Entrust Group. And we look forward to having you again in another Entrust webinar. Thank you.